Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
I am Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, election.princeton.edu.
So today we have our first podcast in front of a live audience, and we're thrilled to be here in New York at the Hotel Aventi, speaking with the Princeton Association of New York City.
A Politics and Polls home companion.
A politics, all right. And we thought it would be fun to do the show with an audience and take some of the time to hear from you and be able to respond to some of the questions. And the dust is finally starting to settle a little bit. And the president-elect, not far away from this hotel, is starting to make some very consequential decisions about the appointments that he will be introducing to the Senate in the coming months. We're starting to get a little bit of a sense of what policies he might want to pursue. We've already had some controversies that have emerged, including his call, his conversation, followed by tweets regarding Taiwan and some of the flare-up that followed with China. And so we do want to reflect a little bit about what happened, but we also want to talk about what's going on and what we can learn about where this all might be going since there's so much material. And one of the things Sam and I have been talking about for a while over the course of this election is the power of polarization in the election. And we basically held that while there are a lot of divisions in the GOP and there were tensions, that polarization still had a pretty powerful impact on the electorate, on politics. And one of the things that I think has been happening with the appointments, Sam, is there's not as much division as I think some suggest. I think you can start to see the outlines of a Trump administration that will fit well with where the congressional Republicans are, who he's going to have to deal with. There's obvious points of difference, big ones, over issues like free trade. But today, at the time of this recording, we heard that he is appointing Scott Pruitt to the EPA, who's been a leading opponent of EPA regulations. And even John Kelly at the Department of Homeland Security. Kelly has been at the forefront of pushing for tighter immigration. And so some of the issues where Trump actually fit with parts of the GOP are now becoming part of the appointments. I don't know what your impression is of what we've been seeing.
Well, I guess my feeling about this is exactly as you've said, and we've talked about before when we've done these podcasts, that a major factor in American politics now is a decades-long trend in polarization. So just to give you a couple of examples of that, despite the public hit that polling and polling analysis took last month, there is a broad sense in which polling data has really told us in advance, and voting statistics have told us in advance, what was going to happen this year and these appointments that we were just hearing about. So, for example, during the primaries, a major force that governed the outcome in the primaries was what one would call direct democracy, a direct link between Trump and his party supporters. Starting back in July, Trump catapulted to the front of the pack, had 30 to 40% support, never looked back, was the strongest Republican nominee since George W. Bush in 2000 in terms of winning the nomination. And so that loyalty that he had within his party, that direct democracy, those are trends that have been building for decades. Polarization in American politics has been building for decades. And as you say, in regard to these decades-long trends, in regard to these appointments reflect who the Republicans are, if not the entire Republican Party, who they've become with their leadership. So voters vote for their party and remain loyal. So the first thing to remember about Trump voters is that Trump voters are Romney voters. And you may not think of Romney as being particularly nativist or anti-immigrant or racialist or racist, but nonetheless, the same people voted for Romney as voted for Trump. And now Trump is the head of the party, and he's become the president-elect. And these appointments that you described reflect the priorities of a pretty considerable part of the Republican Party. And so in many respects, what we're seeing is something that's in many ways deeply unsurprising, right? Trends that have been building for decades within the Republican Party in terms of tone, willingness to alter the political debate and narrative in ways that have become more direct, more willing to upend traditions. And they culminate in things like Scott Pruitt, an anti-climate change lawyer, lobbyist. What does he do? But whatever he is,
Attorney General in Oklahoma.
Yeah, but he has been in the front lines against climate change and against environmental regulation, and it's well in line with Republican Party views to have him in office.
So
whatever draining the swamp we were going to hear about, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the heart of the Republican Party. So then, you know, is that the swamp?
Right. Well, the Republican Party has changed. That's part of the story that we've been following, is it's not your grandmother and grandfather's Republican Party anymore. And the change is not something that's happened in the last election. I've been studying the 1980s and the rise of Congressman Newt Gingrich and his generation of Republicans. And some of the ideas, and not just the policies, but the style of governance, you can see emerging then. Obviously, with the Tea Party, you can see direct links to some of the politics of Trump. And also on the issues, if you take some of the issues he's been talking about, so you take immigration, more hardline stance on immigration is not new to Trump. It's predictable.
It's a thing that's within the party.
It's a thing. And George W. Bush spent much of his administration, the Capitol, trying to push for liberal immigration reform, and he couldn't get it because of the congressional wing of his own party in the House. So the party's changed. The party is still pretty coherent, and I think some of these appointments, Congressman Tom Price, who's going to be the head of Health and Human Services, a leading opponent not only of the Affordable Care Act, but also a proponent of reforming Medicare
privatizing Medicare.
Right, and block grants for Medicaid. It's part of where the party has been going. So for me, I see the appointments, and they're not very surprising. And on national security, similarly, I think he has picked people who are pretty firm advocates, opponents of the Iran deal. They're pretty hawkish in using military force. And Kelly, for example, has been a critic of closing Guantanamo, a critic of human rights organizations on counterterrorism programs. So this is a Republican Party taking shape. And I always tell my students, united government is the one time a lot of things happen. American politics is usually dysfunctional. And we are at a moment that if this all works, the Republicans can really make a lot of big changes.
But there is a surprise, which is that it's a wing of the Republican Party that has previously been either, you know, out of favor, maybe the hawkish wing that wants to go invading a country starting with IRA. Like that part of the party has been in power before.
Yeah.
But there are aspects in which this is a faction of the party that's been out of power, in some sense, held down by party elders. And now they've risen up. And so in some sense, what Trump is one of that wing of the Republican Party, that 30 or 40% that feels this way about trade or immigration. And he's almost literally one of them raised up, because he believes all the things they believe, mm-hmm. whether it be about, you know, the false belief that millions of votes were somehow stolen, which is not true, or other beliefs about climate change being a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, which is also not true. Climate change is caused by carbon dioxide emissions. Well, I don't know. I mean, I see one member of the audience who's, you know, might be taking science classes in the future, and I think we need to. So one thing that is very important, I think, is that one thing that has changed now is that it may be the same voters and the same policies, but the tone of the conversation has changed, mm-hmm. and now it's become necessary to actually do fairly elementary things like point out when a statement is true, and point out when a statement is not true. And so I do feel the need to say, you know, climate change is caused by human activity mostly, things like that. And I think that these basics apparently need to be set.
Yeah. And the media environment in which we live obviously emerged part and parcel with this generation of Republican politics. And it's been a base of Republican politics. I think they're working together in that way. Another issue which is taking place, and we had a discussion, Sam and I, with Jamel Bowie of Slate on another episode, and part of the discussion turned to his thoughts on what the Democrats should do. And so one of the questions to come out of this campaign is, what's gone wrong with Democrats? And some of the discussion will obviously revolve around Hillary Clinton and her strategy in the campaign, and likable, not likable, all those kinds of questions, and the impact of the Comey letter. But another part has now fluctuated to, what's going on with the Democrats and what should they do differently? And there's this very, I think, vigorous debate that's starting to emerge. Part of it is, do the Democrats shift away from what's called identity politics and move to economic issues that Trump seemed to capitalize on in states like Michigan and Wisconsin? Have they become too consumed with issues that don't matter to core voters in the New Deal coalition? And the second issue, Sam, is what do Democrats do with this president? And there is a moral question for some Democrats. They fundamentally found the campaign to be antithetical to many of the beliefs that they have worked on. So how do you cooperate with an administration that represents that or not? Do you cooperate on policies that you don't think will really advance the agenda of the party or help the nation? And politically, there's this debate, do you enter into negotiations and possibly help an administration that you believe will damage the country? So some Democrats, like initially Schumer, are saying we have to negotiate when possible. Even Bernie Sanders said on infrastructure, if he's serious, he'll deal with that. And there's other Democrats who are saying under no circumstances do you cooperate. And they point to a very obvious example, the Republicans. And they say the Republicans didn't cooperate. They didn't seem to care about that. And look where they are. They control more state houses. They control Congress. Their House majorities are big, and now they have the White House. And I think this is a very important debate that the Democrats are going to have to start settling. I don't know where they're going to go, but I think it's a big issue.
Well, a big force there that, again, the big silent presence in the room when thinking about all these things is polarization. So at some level, the question is, what should a party that won the national popular vote at the level of the presidency by 2.6 million votes and counting, what should they change about that? So in one sense, they shouldn't change anything. In another sense, they lost the election. And so the question there is, what could change? And polarization includes a lot of little polarizations within it. If you belong to a particular ethnic group, if you belong to a particular demographic, then it's highly predictable how you're going to vote. If you're Black, highly predictable. Hispanic, highly predictable. White, didn't go to college, predictable. White, evangelical, predictable. Many demographics have become predictable. Some have swung. So Asian Americans, back in the age of Reagan and Bush, used to be split, slightly Republican-leaning, have now moved hard towards the Democrats. And so polarization is a major story in politics. And so at some level, the question is, what to do for some small fraction of people who are swayable? A tiny fraction of voters are swayable. As I said before, Romney voters are Trump voters, and you know, Obama voters almost entirely were Trump voters. So one kind of question is, what should Democrats do? And did I say it wrong?
You might have. Okay,
we can fix it in post. Uh-huh. So the idea is that Obama voters are Clinton voters, yep. And so a few Obama voters peeled off and became Trump voters. But
you're gonna have to eat a bug for saying that.
I actually have some chocolate covered bugs here. Chocolate-covered crickets, see?
Yeah.
So one question is, you know, what should Democrats do? And then there's some question about whether to concentrate on big issues that everybody understands. Minimum wage, saving Medicare, right? Climate change. These are things that everybody understands, simple to get across. But then there's a broader question, which I think gets skipped over because we are so habitually focused on partisan issues, which is, what should Americans do? So we just saw a presidential campaign in which the Republican nominee did something really notably different from the previous Republican nominee. The Republican nominee made explicit promises to ignore laws, to ignore possibly treaties, to not worry too much about constitutional rights. Someone who very evidently had not read the Constitution. I think he thought there were 12 articles in the Constitution, whatever number he thought. He had only a pretty glancing awareness about how government works. And in the face of that, there is a distinct possibility that in addition to the partisanship and the partisan priorities of his party, there's also the possibility that rights can be abrogated, that somebody could get persecuted for having a political opinion, that a business could be persecuted, self-enrichment. Yeah. So I think there are constitutional issues that go beyond party. And so it's not just what Democrats should do, but what Americans should do who care about their country and like things the way they are in terms of how it's run.
Well, I mean, it's related in that one of the issues Democrats are asking is, do you normalize the White House? Do you normalize a president-elect who ran a campaign that in many ways wasn't normal, not just because he said things that we hadn't heard from a mainstream politician, but the other argument that his opponents will have is that he said things that don't work in our constitutional system and actually threaten it. And So what do you do when that person wins power? And it is related to the partisanship in that, again, for me, what you always want to look for when you study presidents is what does the Congress look like?
Yeah. Well, there's a counterfactual to this. So, so Democrats certainly notice, are quicker to notice a problem with going beyond the law and the Constitution. But for anyone in this room who's a Democrat, imagine the following. Imagine a Democratic Congress. Imagine a Democratic president who is rude, who is not too worried about the law, who says awful things, and who will give you single-payer health care and address climate change. What would you do with that president? And because of partisanship and polarization, maybe what you'd do is say, maybe I can put up with that for a little while, and let's just see what that president does, and then we can worry about things like, you know, the law later on. And so polarization does these things to us, and in that respect, this decades-long trend is a thing that
right.
mutates people's behavior.
Right, no, it does, and that's part of the effect of partisanship. It's very simple, and this is what we were talking about, that part of why Donald Trump did well is because Republicans in the end voted Republican. And when you have a polarized electorate, that's what they will do. And what that means is there's a lot more room for the person at the top of ticket of the ticket to do all sorts of things and count on that partisan loyalty to kick in at some point and not to have big defections. So in 1964, one of the elections I often talk about is the 64 election. Barry Goldwater, right-wing Republican, runs against Lyndon Johnson, who's running for re-election. Johnson basically depicts Goldwater as someone who's far too extreme for the country, as someone who will get us into a nuclear war. Some of you remember the famous Daisy ad where you see a little girl counting petals on a flower, saying 1, 2, 3, 4, and then all of a sudden she's interrupted by a government voice, and you see a nuclear explosion and the mushroom in her eye. And this was an essential part of the argument. This was just one example. But the point is, in that campaign, the Democrats were able to win Republican votes in states like Illinois and Wisconsin, including in congressional seats. People flipped over because they said Goldwater was too much. You don't have that anymore. And so it's not simply who wins, but now you have this question in a polarized space. Is there a danger that there's less willingness, especially in united government, to monitor the behavior of someone who has said all these things?
Well, one thing, the thing about the appointments, I think, is that the surprises that have occurred are surprises in the direction of destabilization, right? Like, I don't know, Steve Bannon or this guy Flynn, right, whose son is prone to repeating false stories and made-up news. So I guess my question, in the context of all these appointments that have come out so far, are there any appointments that are surprising in the sense of breaking out of party mold without being shocked?
You mean testing the party?
Well, so for instance, like, yeah, like a cabinet. So for instance, like, is there anything surprising in a non-inflammatory way about, say, Elaine Chao in transportation?
No, not at all. In fact, she's a predictable Republican pick. Yeah. And on labor policy, which is what she did, she was a traditional Republican.
Right.
The party was fine with her in terms of labor policy. She was not an outlier. I actually think if he picks Mitt Romney, despite the drama, the apprentice-like drama that this has now taken on, I think he's not either. Not as much of an outlier either. I read this incredible article at his 2012 campaign on foreign policy, and a lot of his positions that he took then were not that different, really, from some of the issues on Iran. That was a leading issue for him. Ongoing after quote-unquote radical Islam. These were things he was saying. I'm sure he can say them again. He's not a moderate Republican. He might be a more reasonable Republican. He might be a more experienced person. He might be a more civil person. But even that wouldn't surprise me. I think it's been made into a huge drama.
Right. It's like you got 10, I saw on one of these television shows, because, you know, as much as we'd like to get people information through print, we get it through television. No offense, except
you're
great on TV.
Thank you.
But, but you know, a picture of 10 possibilities for Secretary of State. And I looked at that, and I saw something on Twitter go by saying, and now these candidates will split into teams of 5.
Yeah.
And whoever sells more T-shirts will advance.
That's basically what it is. And I do suspect that Romney might actually get this.
On grounds that he... from central casting.
Yeah, central. When President-elect Trump said he looks like what the Secretary of State. People should listen to that. I think that really matters to him. It also creates this political drama with a resolution which will work very well in his favor in terms of I did pick my opponent. And at the same time, I don't think it's that much of a risk to the general policies he wants because Romney will follow through on it. You just have to look at Romney's own record to see that. And we have to remember, in the modern White House, it's easy to contain the Secretary of State. It's the National Security Advisor in a centralized White House that has much of the power. This could be like Kissinger and Nixon. And I think Mike Flynn could really be the last person in the room, and Mitt Romney could be a nice person to show around. But in the end, I'm not convinced, if he does want to be an outlier, that he'll have that much power to do so. And I don't think he'd be as much of an outlier as we think. The key issues with Trump, it's fighting ISIS, it's possibly overturning or weakening the Iran deal, or more importantly, to show it's not working, and then to enforce it through military force. Those are the two key issues, and I think Romney could fit comfortably. That's a long way to answer that I don't see any surprising outliers at this point. Bannon was a little bit. I do think Bannon's work, he's not surprising for Trump, but it's still surprising just as an observer to see someone who had that kind of work with Breitbart and a lot of the things that are said there and some of the groups. To have him in the White House means, I think that's significant. And it's notable, even if it doesn't surprise me that Trump did that, obviously. It
gets back to the issue of the range of what's acceptable to talk about. So it may be the same voters who voted Republican 4 years ago, but this time they voted for a guy who appointed Bannon, and Bannon's on record as saying, yeah, a property ownership requirement for voting might be okay. Might be okay if fewer black people voted. That might not be a bad thing. And so that's something that previously would have been considered an unthinkable thing to say.
Yeah.
And now it's what the guy who's 10 feet from the Oval Office said. And so the tone of what's changed. So, you know, it's, you know, voters vote for leaders, and then leaders change the temperature.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, the leaders to change the temperature, some of the tweets. I just wrote a column on presidential tweeting. And I think actually that's going to be a
all your professional training.
All of my, but you know what? I think it should be taken seriously now. And I read about FDR in radio. I read about Kennedy and Reagan in TV and the way they use the mechanism. So I like to teach it. Some people here have taken a class where I teach about Reagan. He used the line of the day, which Dave Gergen and Michael Deaver, every day in the morning, they'd basically coordinate a message that would be orchestrated for television. And everyone who had a public appearance would follow with that theme, and it was a very powerful mechanism. It was serious stuff in terms of selling the administration. This is a means of communication for him, and I think there's going to be ramifications for some of what's coming out if it keeps coming out that way. So if the president-elect tweets that there was massive voter fraud with 2.5+ million people somehow being fraudulent, that matters. It matters to have him say it now in ways it didn't even matter to have him say it 6 months ago. When he followed up with the call to Taiwan with very provocative tweets. In diplomacy, that can matter. So it has to be taken seriously when he makes these kinds of statements. So there are a lot of kind of little things like that that aren't so little, and I think are part of the concerns that you have that I think will have to be looked at in terms of a new kind of presidential style. So I think soon we'd like to turn it over to some Q&A. Do you have any closing thoughts before we do?
Just that I think that this is a pretty challenging time, and I think we have our eyes on these events that happen on a national stage and appointments that happen out of reach of our everyday lives. But I do think that this is an unusual time. I mean, again, getting past the partisan labels, the question of what people can do to maintain institutions that are considered valuable. A thing that's very much on my mind is what can people do to, you know, maintain the good things about American institutions? And I think that there are ways in which the press, voter engagement, and how we deal with our representatives, I think these things are going to be tested in ways that haven't been tested in recent years.
And I just say that I do believe that this is one of these partisan moments where a lot can happen. And I don't buy, A, that there's all this compromise that's about to be on the table.
You mean things like
I think
Obamacare and Medicare?
I think the Republicans have the capacity to do a lot. So back to my 64, I like to write about Lyndon Johnson, not as an all-powerful president who knew how to do all this magic and work Congress the way no one else did, but he had social movements, he had Congress with huge liberal majorities, and that opened up opportunities. I think this is a reversal of that, and I think this can be as consequential a few years in terms of reversing some of the developments from the Obama time, the Obama presidency, reversing some of the Great Society programs that have been around much longer. This is a serious moment we're facing, and I don't know how it will unfold, but I think if you see these appointments, you see the power of polarization, you see where the Republican Congress is and their power in the state legislative bodies, you have to understand that this is, it's not simply a quirky lineup that's just happened. The capacity to really undertake a conservative revolution, defined conservatism circa 2016-17, is on the table right now. And I think that's, for me, a big question in addition to the institutions. Do we look back at this as a sea change moment? So we're going to take questions. Raise your hand, and she's going to pass a mic so we can record your question.
Hi. So I think this question might expose that I'm indeed a millennial. But I think something new for elections, maybe has only existed for two or three elections, is network-based technology tools or media. Simple thing would be Facebook, even LinkedIn. Do you, and then touching on the theme of polarization, would you think that those types of tools where you are exposed to things produced by people like you or have similar beliefs or geographically close to you, is that exposing the trend of polarization or actually accelerating it? If that's too easy or not interesting enough.
No, that's good. Okay. I think it accelerates it. It doesn't have to be an either or answer. So polarization is not caused by Facebook. But I do think Facebook is having some pretty profound effects on how your generation and older generations, such as us, consume the news. And the fake news phenomenon that we have seen this election is being propelled through this. One of the more interesting things on Facebook is how you get news feeds that fit with your likes. That's a basic part of Facebook. And that is a problem. And it's certainly, if you have an electorate that already doesn't like to think about the other side and that likes to understand issues within your own worldview, having a news feed like that is a problem. I don't think Facebook's going to do anything about it. But these networks accelerate that.
So I would say, roughly speaking, media fragmentation is the thing that Julian's talking about. It's one thing to have the news read to you from a source that you like, where it's agreeable to you, so that could be that's fact-checked, and that would be, depending on what your point of view is, could be The Nation or it could be The Wall Street Journal. So that's one kind of information. But then Facebook adds a layer of false information, and that's a new thing. But I should also say that these things are not new trends. And so when I have analyzed elections and looked at voter polarization, there's a substantial increase in polarization and a real entrenchment of voters, where voters become more loyal to their party. And that goes back to the mid-1990s. And the mid-1990s were a time when Newt Gingrich and his allies took over Congress on both sides. It's also a time when rapid, efficient ways of reaching people who agree with you occurred, right? So first, talk radio with Rush Limbaugh, then also things like Fox News. And so if you're a Republican in Princeton, say, then you can reach a Republican in Wyoming pretty easily. If you're a Democrat in Utah, then you can reach a Democrat in Boston pretty easily. And so there are ways in which these kinds of communication have been around for a few decades, and Facebook is just the fastest, most out-of-control version of it, right? Where Rush Limbaugh could speak to his followers in the mid-1990s, and the voice on loan from God could speak, that's his little slogan, the voice on loan from God could speak to his supporters immediately. I remember once riding on a bus in San Diego being so persuaded by this voice. And now Donald Trump, with his perfectly normal-sized thumbs, is able to just communicate directly with millions of people who agree with him, right? He's one of them. And so I think that this is a new challenge. It's true that Facebook may not be temperamentally wanting to address it, but there is a sense in which these utilities, like these organizations like Facebook and LinkedIn, are public utilities, right? They provide a general service, even though they do it privately for profit. There is a sense in which they are a vital part of the American conversation, and we are dependent on those forms of conversation. And that's an important thing to think about You know, if you're Mark Zuckerberg or what have you.
I did meet one of the founders at a small dinner of Facebook. I won't name who it was, and I asked that question, like, you founded this, can't you do something about it? And he said he couldn't. He said there was no way users of Facebook would tolerate if you change that basic structure of Facebook, where it's all everything's geared to likes. That's the premise of the they've tried certain things, and instantly there's this kind of anti-regulatory sentiment in it. So it's difficult.
But they have discretion. Yeah. They could do it. It's just that
they could.
But they don't want to as a corporate decision.
Or they don't feel that they can, and that the users would be okay with it.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think that is going to be degrading to government, or to the stability of civil society. And that, you know, and there's going to be a new Facebook that comes along, right? There's going to be like 4chan and 5chan and 6chan or whatever.
Okay, another question.
Yeah, sorry about that long answer.
Right here and then here.
How effective do you think public protest could be in face of some of the decisions that the new administration might make?
Well, public protest can be very powerful, and it can't be fleeting public protest. So, you know, if you are talking about protests against President-elect Trump, if that's the question, the kinds of protests that happen after the election right here in New York probably aren't going to have much of an effect. They didn't really have much of a goal. They were fleeting. They're over almost as soon as they started. And it wasn't clear exactly where it was going. But we've seen protests in recent decade that have had an effect. One on the right, the Tea Party movement. It's been a very effective protest. I believe that. I believe it's been effective at the grassroots. It's been effective in Washington. It has changed the tenor of the Republican Party. It's gotten issues and candidates on the table. I believe Black Lives Matter has been very effective, even though it's often criticized, at getting questions of institutional racism at the forefront of our debates, from criminal justice to policing to drug reform, drug law reform. And so protests matter. And back to my story of the 60s, you can't tell it. You can't understand why all this happens without the civil rights movement. And I think that still holds today. The protests might be different. They might be more decentralized. They might rely more on social media. But that will be incredibly important in terms of checking this president, changing the issues either party talks about. Politicians don't like to do that on their own.
In many ways, the current time, depending on your point of view, is like the converse of the civil rights movement, where regular people could get involved and do something and maybe move the needle a tiny bit. And now would be a time when the ordinary decencies we take for granted, if you're an ordinary person, it probably is time to do more than an ordinary amount. And the question here is, you might be able to change something. You know, protests are probably not going to change the Electoral College. But, you know, you don't know what's going to change things. And so protest is a little bit like prayer or going to church, in the sense that, look, God is just as great whether or not you go to church. But you getting out there makes you better. And so there are ways in which protesting unifies people and brings together a movement. And, you know, there are reasons to do it. It may not be the person who's arguing in front of the Supreme Court changing the law. It may not be the person who's introducing legislation. But I think there's a role for protest.
It's also very important when you have whatever the structure of politics, it's usually protest or grassroots movement that will change it. So in the 60s, the problem was too much bipartisanship. And you had these Southern Committee Democrats who teamed up with Midwestern Republicans like Everett Dirksen, and they accepted some changes, but generally they stifled progress on a lot of issues. And in the end, that's part of what the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement was about. More partisanship, empowering party leaders. And they were the only way in which you really were able to shake up the system, having people force politicians to do that. And I think it's the same right now. There's no reason for Republicans or Democrats to change the basic way politics is conducted, not on political grounds. I mean, Democrats might now feel a little bit more of this because they're losing. But usually incumbents like the system. So it really is, I believe, bottom-up pressure is what leads to big changes.
There was one notable person who got the election right, a man named Professor Lichtman, who supposedly used historical analysis. And then recently he claimed that they made another prediction that Trump was going to be impeached.
Yeah.
It seems as if, you know, the one person, Republican, who would stand up to Trump if he goes over the Constitution would be John Roberts, because I don't think John Roberts wants to cede his authority.
So first I should say that the public conversation is full of wrong ideas, and one of the wrong ideas is that Professor Lichtman got his prediction right. So I just have to remind you that his prediction was strictly about the popular vote, okay? Because he said, oh, based on my 12 keys to power, which has always gotten it right. For instance, if you count Bush v. Gore, it got Gore right because Gore won the popular vote. So that was what he said. So he was pretty explicit about predicting the popular vote, and so he was explicitly wrong this year. I do not know of a single polling organization or a single data-based pundit who made a prediction who was right this year, and that includes Lichtman. So that's my answer to the first part. Your actual question was about John Roberts.
I'm not going to get involved in the predictors, prognosticators debates. I'm just the historian here. Alan is as well.
I'm just saying.
But Roberts will not be able to do that on his own. If some of the concerns that Sam is talking about come to fruition, it's going to have to be congressionally based opposition to make something happen. I mean, there could be court challenges for sure. We might see, but the obvious way in which you challenge a president is through Congress. And the question is, does the polarization and Republican control of Congress overwhelm any desire to, it doesn't even have to be impeachment level stuff, but to really investigate and conduct oversight? Or is this a period of 4 years of quiet where that doesn't happen?
But you can imagine cases brought into the Supreme Court, say, for instance, the emoluments clause of the Constitution, where you're not supposed to get a payment if you're a high official, and you know Trump is getting payments through his properties. So that could come to the Supreme Court.
It could. But it's still a gray area, and I think it's still going to require congressional intervention to deal even with something like that.
What do we do in the civic space about the seeming lack of interest in and respect for fact?
That's a problem. Look, I think it's a very important issue. I think the changes we talked about in the media, some of it is about a more partisan media, the Fox News / MSNBC media. But part of it is about the filters going away in our mechanisms of modern communication. And this is certainly, I'm in the world of the news and I see this all the time. There's just not a lot of checks on what people say and what people write. This could be good. I mean, it creates space for people who aren't institutional stakeholders in the New York Times to say things and to write things. But it's also created a more dangerous side where people say anything. And now they are supported by a president-elect who's also happy to say anything. And what's hard is to hear students or hear people you meet not debate Republican versus Democratic positions or liberal versus conservative, which is important and great, but to just say things that are just not true. Yeah. The voter fraud issue is one area we hear a lot of that, kind of accusations about what's going on that have no basis in fact. And that's damaging. There is no reversing, though, the internet. There is no reversing the changes that have taken place in the media. So I think we're just going to have to find more powerful voices in journalism, in academia, in civic life to compete and counteract when things are out there that are just factually not true. But the factually untrue is part of our political discourse for a while.
I do think that as much as people talk about social media, I think it's a little bit overblown in the sense that people still get a lot of their information through television, through major media outlets. And, you know, I've been thinking about exactly how to translate this into what a person can do. What could you or I do about these things? And so I think there's an important role, not just in conveying stories that are true or not true, but also keeping the media on task. So I often encourage people who follow the news stories that I feed them on Twitter. So I say, look, if you think this headline is inaccurate, maybe you should send a friendly note to the person who writes the headlines at, you know, CBS or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or what have you, and give them feedback on that. And I think that there is this sense in which media organizations don't care that much about what we say individually, but we do have some small amount of influence in keeping people honest, whether it's be, you know, the tweet writer at CBS News or what have you. And so I think a difficulty is not just the accuracy of stories, but also the choice of stories. And a big challenge, I think, in general, that we didn't even realize that was important until after the aftermath of this election, is that there is a sense in which the press needs to be kept on track. And I think people in the Republicans have been very good about this. They say that media is biased against them, but they're mobilized in ways to really notice when something is biased against them, and they point it out. And I think, broadly speaking, citizens broadly have the option to give feedback and keep the media on track.
The good news is, look, we have a nostalgia for the media the same way we have a nostalgia for journalism, for politics, about the good old days. And all periods of journalism have a dysfunctional element. So the 19th century, the press was explicitly a partisan organ. Everything you saw had a partisan purpose. The newspapers were controlled by the parties.
William Hearst.
Right, right. And the high point of the press for many people is the 50s and 60s, objective journalism controlled by the Times and some newspapers and a few networks. But that was also a problem in that politicians figured out that the press won't be aggressive with us. And so Joe McCarthy just said stuff all the time, and the press reported on it without analysis. Early in Vietnam, most of the press corps took their news right from the military press officers. It would take about 3 or 4 years before you really started to see hard-hitting journalism from people like Harrison Salisbury, who were going out there and saying, this isn't what's going on. And that's how eventually we end up with the Woodward and Bernstein adversarial investigative reporting. So my point is, it's also important to see how the press can remake itself. I believe there's a lot of good voices in the press right now. I do believe that. And I think this is one of those moments where it's going to be essential, not just because of President-elect Trump, just because of what's happened in journalism, for those voices to become more pronounced and to keep doing good work. But the press can remake itself. We've seen that a million times over. I think we have time for one last question.
The title on the marquee, I guess, was What Went Wrong Relative to the Polling. And as we see the popular vote trickling in, you know, Clinton was ahead 3%. It looks like she maybe had 2%. So nationwide wasn't so far off. Obviously, in the Midwest, it was. But the bigger question, I think, for polling, how do pollsters identify the correlation between the 9% of people who will talk to a pollster and the 60% of people who will show up at the polls? And, you know, they talk about the Bradley effect, things in the past where there was a specific situation. People weren't giving honest answers or weren't responding. But it seems like you always have that, particularly if response rates are 9%, something's happening to distinguish those 9 from the other 91 that is immeasurable. I can't imagine how you would get it right.
So the answer is that pollsters have taken a beating over the last month or so, but there is a deeper sense in which they do a very good job. And there's a lot of professionalism that goes into that. So in the face of low response rates, pollsters have done a pretty good job of reaching various demographics. If more young people vote than are in the sample, then they count the young people's responses more heavily. If lots of old people are at home picking up the phone, then they count those responses a little bit less. The failure this year was actually not a failure of pollsters in the sense of getting their samples right. It appears to be a failure specifically having to do with Donald Trump, namely that early in the season there was a substantial fraction of Republican voters who didn't seem to be ready to come home to their candidate. And Trump was specifically underperforming in states that Romney won in 2012. And in the end, the polling error was very much focused on these same red states. And so the polling error in Trump states was about 6 percentage points on median. And the polling error in states that Hillary Clinton won was 0.2 percentage points on median. And so it seemed to be a specific polling error having to do with what might call the shy Trump voter. Either they didn't want to tell the pollster, or maybe they just didn't know that they were eventually going to pull the lever for a Republican. Because I've had times when I've gone to the voting booth and not known what I was going to do, and then I get in there and I push the button, and I wasn't able to say beforehand what I was going to do. So what can pollsters do? I mean, in some sense, what they need to do is find ways to pull out that bias. And now I'm going to put on the cognitive science hat for just a moment and say that there are ways to pull out hidden biases and hidden predilections. A simple thing that could have been done this year would be to point out that in Wisconsin, Russ Feingold was having a pretty hard time in his race against Ron Johnson. That's a polling, and Feingold's the Democrat, Johnson's the Republican. And that's a question, that's a case in which partisan preference was asked without using the word T-U-R-M-P. Okay, and so in that case, it was possible to extract preference. And there are tools for doing this. A reader of my website was able to use Google search terms and Google Correlate to predict primary behavior on both the Republicans and Democrats. So I think there, A, pollsters aren't that bad. B, there are new ways to deal with it. So I think there are ways to address this. And what we saw was an error that was very much of its own kind, a Trumpy kind of error.
I think. So I'll just jump in for a second. I'm not a pollster, so I just do a podcast with one.
No,
I know you're not
either.
A pollster. I got it. But you're close.
Thanks.
But I don't even do anything like that. But, you know, for me, I don't know the technicalities of what went wrong. It sounds to me that where we started this conversation, there was a sense that polarization might work differently this time, where it didn't in the end, in terms of those voters coming home. Two, it's a natural disbelief, whatever, if you're Republican or Democrat, that our current president-elect was going to win. And I don't know if that plays into the polling, but I'm sure it played into the reporting. And
yes,
that's not just a bias that you don't like him even. It's a disbelief that the guy from The Apprentice and a guy who ran a campaign that was far outside what we have seen in mainstream campaigns on many issues, and we haven't seen this. We shouldn't now forget that and just move on to the kind of post-election coverage. It's natural in the middle of that, if you have a kind of narrow race or a narrower race, that you just assume the system is going to go to the person who comes out of the system.
I think that it's a case for being closer to the data, because the data, when examined closely, actually showed that the race was within a few
right.
points. And right. so despite the error
it's
of
the
my prediction, right, there is this sense
it's
in which people should, in fact, pay some attention to data and notice when
right.
a situation is close. And that's a responsibility of voters, of media.
And that's what some reporters have said. It was the way they described the data, not the data, which was the problem. And part of that came from the bias. And it's not necessarily, again, a liberal against conservative bias. It's just a bias. He's not going to win. And the closeness, and it went that way. And finally, let's just remember, with all the postmortem, it was she won the popular vote. The votes in these states like Michigan and Wisconsin are extraordinarily narrow. And so it's important not to make the mistake we always make in a lot of campaigns, that this is a mandate, it's a total change in terms of where the population of America is. It's much, much messier than that. And I think that's also an important lesson. That wraps up our episode. Thanks to everyone in the Princeton Association in New York for joining us here, for joining the conversation, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.